welcome to another exciting episode of Kick Arts, Auckland's comprehensive art show brought to you every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6 or live streamed at planetaudio.org.nz or listen to on our podcast, which goes live 5 minutes after the show. So if there's something that you hear that you think sounds great, you can share it with someone, or something that you think sounds like someone will hate it, you can send it on to them as a little prank to them. It'll be great. I am very, very excited to be hosting tonight. Obviously, this is not the voice of normal host Richard Green. He is away doing his own little arts-related project in Christchurch. So I am here. I am Georgia. I have brought my own co-host. It's Tess Barker. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you going?
Good. And you're going to be reviewing your weekend.
I'm going to be reviewing a magnificent weekend at Splore, which was just fantastic. I won't ruin
it.
10 out of 10 for Splore.
Okay, fantastic. And it's a very exciting time of year in the arts. I think I was talking about that with Natasha and Brittany, who are here to review. Can you review your own show? No, to promote your show here. Could you just introduce yourselves and tell us what you're here to talk about tonight?
So I'm Brittany.
And I'm Natasha.
And we are members of Dance Plant Collective, a contemporary dance collective formed out of Unitech. We studied together in 2014 to 2016, and we're putting on a show, a double bill in Fringe that opens on Thursday and goes till Sunday.
Fantastic. So, okay. Yeah. Have you done a show as a part of Fringe before, or is this your first?
No, I've never performed a show before, just witness shows, so it's very, very exciting. Yeah,
Fringe is so, I'm such a fan of Fringe, like, yeah. Of all the festivals, I think Fringe and Auckland's Arts Fest. So, I did say Fringe and Auckland Arts Fest, which obviously borders right on.
Shade, I call shade.
Sorry, that is the voice of Tama Waipa, who is here to talk about Auckland Arts Fest.
Thank you.
Okay, sorry, I'll get you to introduce your show, but then actually after we've introduced everyone, I thought I might play a song which would be related to your show. Yes? You look stoked. Yeah, but I'll do it in like 5 minutes, don't worry, I've got it all planned out. I rehearsed on the way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can tell. So your show is Love Me As I Am.
Kilda. Love Me As I Am is one of the shows in the entire Auckland Arts Festival,
yes.
But my role there is Senior Program Manager,
mm-hmm.
So I look after the entire music program.
Mm-hmm.
Love Me As I Am, the music of Mahi Narangi Toka, is a show dedicated to the memory of one of our great Māori musicians, Mahi Narangi Toka.
And just the briefing that I got, you are involved in that show, aren't you?
Yes, I'm the creative director.
Ah, fantastic. We're like, Tess and I in particular, were super excited when we started reading up about that show, because we have a bit of like a personal connection there, that she came and played one of the first festivals that our dad runs, the Tatarangi Music Festival.
Oh, wow.
And she played one of the first festivals, and it was just one of those shows that you go to and it just totally changes the way that you see music and totally changes the way that you see community. So I will actually play one of her songs soon, one of favourite one of one of her songs. But first, welcome, Phoebe.
Hi.
And you are here to talk about The Two Gentlemen of Verona.
That's right, yeah. Which is another Fringe Festival show, which is on for the next 2 weeks.
Cool, fantastic. Yeah. I am a little curious about that as well, because I've never seen this play before, but I did a bit of a read-up about it, and it seems like cheeky, bit of a play on gender,
yeah.
Quite good.
Yeah,
yes.
It is all of these things. It's not a Shakespeare that many people have seen live,
yeah.
Before or read before.
Yeah.
It's not one of his well-known works, but it's really, really good.
Yeah. Do you think that's maybe one of the reasons why you and the other people who have put it on were attracted to it as well?
Yeah, totally. It's Shakespeare's first play that he wrote, or is believed to be by most people. I guess it's kind of hard to know for sure. But, so it's a little, like, it's quite similar to lots of his other comedies.
Yeah.
So I think that's possibly why some of the other ones get a bit more of a run, is that lots of the formulas and structures are also in Two Gentlemen of Verona. But, this one came first, so
Cool, fantastic. Cool. Okay, excited to hear a bit more about that. And last but not least, welcome Greg Rohan, author.
Hello, hi.
What are you here to talk to us about tonight?
I'm here on the obnoxious self-promotion circuit, so...
don't worry, we're fans of that here.
So, I've written a couple of new books. I'd written one novel a wee while ago, and I've just done book number two in a young adult series that I've been working on, and it's a lot of fun.
Cool. And that's the Beth Singer series.
Yes.
I was doing a little bit of a read-up about that before, and I was getting very excited because I'm quite a fan of, like, a teen fiction-y type thing, and I was thinking this looks like... kind of Morris G. Half Man meets O met with Man vs. Wild, of which I'm also a big fan.
Yay, yeah. To be compared to Morris G. Would be pretty awesome. Yeah, it is a little bit like that. That kind of, I guess, did the Half Man of O had a, it had, was it Susan Ferris was the female main character?
Yeah.
And look, I read those books when I was a kid, like a lot of people did, but I've also just not ever stopped reading young adult fiction, and I think Philip Pullman and his Dark Material stuff, and so I guess when I was writing this, I was really writing for adult readers of young adult fiction, but then it's like, oh yeah, young people might enjoy this as well. So yeah, it's a fun space to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even like talking about Morris G, the Under the Mountain, we've got a show of that. I'm not sure where it is. Somewhere in the city Auckland right now, Theatre which Company. I Auckland Theatre Company. Nice. I've heard it's amazing.
It's just finished. Yeah.
Yeah. Did anyone see it?
No. Yeah. Directed by Sarah Brody, who's an amazing director.
Yeah, I heard that it was really. I mean, because that book is like. I remember reading that when I was like 11 and giving it to my dad and being like, you have to read this. It's like a classic.
Yeah. I went for a swim at, is it Thorn Bay, near Takapuna, and I was just sort of milling about in the warm water, and there's this older lady next to me, and we're just sort of, you know, swimming there, treading water, being middle-aged. And I said, oh, a bit of a cold current. She said, oh, that's the springs that squeeze out here from Pupuki, you know, Lake Pupuki. And I was like, oh, yeah. Wasn't that in like Under the Mountain or something? Didn't they like do something in that book? And she was like, oh, well, that's just finished filming. I think Sam Neill was in that. And they actually used our house as the home of the rich Auckland family that they go see.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a very random conversation. Yeah.
Small world.
Yeah.
Now, while it's just loading, and hopefully it... I did try my computer and now I tried my phone, but it doesn't seem to be. It's having a bit of a funny time. Would it be okay, Tama, if you just talk to us a little bit about your connection to the show, Love Me As I Am, and your involvement and why it is that you, I presume, are loving being involved, because you've got a big smile on your face.
Yeah, actually, it's a lot like your experience. I saw Mahinarangi on a TV show when I was at university a million years ago, and was just blown away by this incredible kind of otherworldliness about her. She was raucous, funny, deep thinking, poignant, vulnerable, and had just this voice that could go anywhere and did go anywhere. It was no song that she wrote was ever the same twice. And then I became a fan of her music and a bit of a groupie, and later on had the pleasure of meeting her and working with her, and got to experience firsthand her generosity.
Yeah.
And she was this amazing collaborator as well. She was really interested in otherness and other sounds and instruments and styles of music, and she was really brave about... experimenting, and she was an incredible nurturer. She just in this journey of making the show, which is a tribute to her. I mean, for those who don't know, Mahinarangi passed away 10 years ago. Mm. So it's still very raw and vulnerable for a lot of people, obviously for her family first and foremost. But as an arts community, I think we all felt robbed of this wonderful creative, and you know, she wrote over 1,000 songs. She worked with an incredible array of people. She worked with Michael Parmenter on Jerusalem. She worked with Ross Harris, who wrote a suite, orchestral suite, dedicated to her memory. She celebrated her taha Māori, her you know, Māori side, but she equally explored her Celtic and Hebrew origins within her music and with other musicians. So it's a joy. It's quite a nerve-wracking thing to do, because I don't think anything will ever do her justice.
Yeah.
But fortunately, that doesn't sit on my shoulders, because it's shared with all of these incredible artists.
Yeah.
Shona Lang, Charlotte Yates, Marie Sheehan, Wana Maniapoto, Heniwehi Mohi, Anika Moore, Nadia Reid, who didn't actually know her but knew her music and jumped in, Emma Pucky.
So eclectic. You know, it just goes to show that her audience, I mean, even
Annie Crummer.
Yeah, it's just like that her audience, audience doesn't sit right, because it feels like more than that. It feels like more of a connection. And when I listen to her music, I feel like her as an activist, like in the way that it's so empowering and it lifts you up. And I was just listening to some this afternoon as I was doing some work, and I just felt it kind of gave me this little kind of fire in my belly. And I love that as well, that as someone who's non-Māori, I can connect with her music in that way as well. It's a really special thing.
And she was like that. She, while having really staunch ideals and values, and this has also been amazing, just, you know, going beyond what I knew and digging deeper to find out more. And I guess I came along at quite a late point, where she'd already done a huge amount. So going back and learning all of that and discovering things, and the industry into which she came, which was male and white and straight and commercially driven and exploitative and manipulative and all of those things, and she stood firm and was herself and refused to compromise her artistry to bow to that. And you know, maybe commercially that didn't work in her favour, but you know, absolutely her artistry reigned supreme. I'll always love that about her.
I'm kind of thinking of how, like, as you're speaking, this idea that so often with artists, particularly music artists, we've got this idea about having a brand, you know, what are you going to sell? And maybe she kind of proves otherwise, you know. And we've got some other incredible New Zealand musicians. Chris Knox is someone who comes to mind, people who are just genuine and they don't need a brand, because people just love that.
Shane Carter.
Absolutely.
Is
there a particular song that you would like?
No, I really want to know what song spoke to you.
If it's all right, I actually really wanted When I Grow Up, which I know is, I was about to say The Hit, but that's maybe not quite right. I know, like, that was probably the first song that I heard from her, and I remember that year that she played at the Titirangi Festival where I first discovered her. I remember there was a CD from that year, and that was her song on the CD, and I just remember our household listening to it over and over again. So if that's all right, I'd like to play that one, if that's okay.
Don McGlashan's actually singing that on the night.
He's actually playing, he's the headliner at the Titirangi Festival this year.
Very exciting.
I love the Titirangi Music Festival.
All right, fantastic. All right, so this is When I Grow Up from Mahiranga Toka, and we'll be back in a second. Thank you.
Singer or an actor or writer of something new. You're never too old to cry, never too young to reason, never too old to try, never too young to reason. I want to be mad with courage, lost in living. I want to be crazy with passion, find myself. We'll be right back.
Such a beautiful song. That was actually quite special, just being in the studio with everybody kind of having a bit of a groove and having a bit of like a talk about it. Sorry, you were just in the middle of saying something that I was intrigued by, but the song finished. You were saying the funny thing.
Oh, just so that song was used for a mental health awareness campaign, and Mahi Narangi, who was very public about her own mental health issues and struggles and successes. I just think it's ironic because she had a youthful playfulness that, you know, I mean, it's bittersweet, the fact that she's not around to grow further and to create more, but it's also funny because I think of her as having that naughty streak as well. And someone who hadn't grown up in some senses.
Yeah, I love that. So relatable as well. It's the kind of song that it doesn't... I mean, and we were talking about that before, how eclectic it is. The not only her listeners, but the people who are involved in the show, that, you know, maybe it kind of is that relatability, you know, and that playfulness that everybody can... I mean, like, even just in our family, that it's like our parents love it, we love it. I'm sure that little Joshy would be a fan as well. He's our little brother that we'll... Is he going to be a part of your review test?
Josh Parker?
Yeah.
Pride of the family?
Pride of the family.
Yeah, he'll be part of the review.
Yeah, cool. We could post our photo of us with T-shirts with his face on the with the this week's post. And we were just talking as well during the song break about the kind of the bubbles that we get in terms of obviously the arts community is small in Auckland, but you do get involved in your bubble, and Brittany and Natasha were talking a little bit about the dance bubble. What is the dance bubble? How do you get out of the dance bubble?
I feel like the strongest time of the dance bubble was when we were studying, because it was a very rare, like, 9 to 5 of dance, and then at night time you'd go home and do more dance or like go to a show or something. Like, not every day, but you know, and then you come out 3 years later and you're like, oh, okay, like, you know, there's other stuff out there, but I don't know, you don't feel as restricted to just do that. There's like you know, more to explore, or other people to collaborate with, even just the people that we studied with, or
Do you think that's... I know that I've just come out of UniTech myself, but totally different qualification. But I know that they say that the arts departments here being that we're in the UniTech campus, but we're not part of UniTech. But the in UniTech, that the arts departments are super super strong, and they produce some incredible performers. But it seems as though as a part of that, you guys grow hard. I mean, even listeners wouldn't have been able to see the slightly mad eyes that you had when you were saying, like, 9 to 5 dancing and then going home and continuing to dance. But do you think that's maybe slightly part of the culture, that you kind of stick to your discipline and then... Or do you kind of get to know the other... Like, are there collaborations within the school or...?
Yeah. We didn't actually do that much collaboration as dance students. I know that the actors collaborated quite a lot with the screen arts students, doing films and things. But we do actually, for this show as well, we are collaborating with a couple of people that we have. Oh, Paul Bennett is a lighting technician who studied at UniTech, and he actually designed and did the lights for our last show as well. So that's kind of like a lasting relationship, which is really cool.
He's amazing, by the way.
The other, because it is two pieces within the one performance, right? Sorry, or is it two performances within the one piece? So is it the other choreographer, is she also from UniTech?
Bella Wilson. So we're creating a double bill. We've got a piece
me and Britt and I were creating a duet together, and then Bella's created a work with the rest of the dance ball, a couple more of the Dance Plant Collective members to perform. So, yeah, a double bill with kind of two pieces that I guess have interlinking ideas at some points, but quite different and experimental. So, yeah.
I found the name of the piece just really intriguing, The Cost of Arms and Legs.
Yeah.
What's that about? What does that reflect in the piece?
Well, it's more so to do with Bella's piece, because her starting point for that piece was working with idioms, and so here we are just googling away idioms, and there's, you know, things that we use every day that you just know off the top of your head, and then there's some other idioms that are like, what does that mean? Like, I have no idea. And we found that one, The Cost of Arms and Legs, and we just thought that was really interesting, and then that related to the piece as well.
What does the cost of arms and legs mean?
Cost of arms and legs. Isn't it?
It's going to cost me an arm.
I always get. I'm confused about it now because we've just kind of like blown it apart for the show. So yeah. I'm like,
I don't know where that came from. Shakespeare came up with so many of our idioms in the English language.
A lot of them you don't even realize.
You know, the Merchant of Venice. That's like they pay in a pound of flesh, which is like breast flesh, but not an arm or a leg, but.
Exactly, and you don't even think about it now, but it does have darker connotations.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Especially the poor people that have to learn English and learn all of our...
That's strange.
That's me, I'm the book guy. I work with... Most of my friends are idioms. we're having a little... I don't know, at my work, I work at a content marketing agency, and so we kind of... You know, we constantly talk about writing and language and that sort of thing. We're just mucking around. I think I just put up a test about different idioms. There's so many funny ones, and most of it is just like spelling them right. But things like toe the line, you know, it's just like mentally everyone thinks T-O-W, but of course it's a T-O-E because it's military. But you toe the line, at the parade time where you got to, you know, toe the line, bro, like...
All of a sudden, it just made more sense as well. The idea of like toe the line, like with your toe, all of a sudden, it's a lot more visual, tangible.
There's another one, you talk about something being a bellwether as an indicator for something. And in my head, I've always had this kind of bell that you ring when the weather's kind of weathering. But it's a weather, W E T H E R, and a weather is a kind of sheep. Is it a boy sheep that's had its. A wether is a sheep, and a bellwether is the one sheep that you have in the flock that's got a bell on it. So when the wolves come in, ding a ding 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 ding, and that's your bellwether is your indicator of danger.
Never think that, eh?
It's just fun that somewhere there's the cost of an arm and leg is going to have a really odd story behind it.
I'm so interested to see how that comes across as dance, especially as, according to your guys' website for the Dance Plant Collective, it's politically challenging and transformative performance work grounded in an ecological framework, which sounds like a lot. I was wondering if you could, like, do those sort of three big concepts there being politically challenging, transformative, and then ecological, are those based in the work that you're... doing now?
More so that was was written when we were working on our first show all together, which was called Desire Lines, and it was about like the desire lines that everyone takes. You know, there's like the paths that you see that are formed for humans to walk on, and there's those little paths that are
like shortcuts almost.
Yeah, shortcuts. And so we kind of went on that tangent. So those things are definitely part of Desire Lines more so. But I think that whatever you make, even if that's not your intention in the first place, anything can come from it. And then if someone asks you what your piece is about or you write about it or something, then you suddenly like, oh, this could actually... anyone could take whatever they want from it into... For someone else, that could like trigger something like, oh, that's quite heavy for me, or like, oh, that's just nice. You know, like everyone has different reactions to it. So,
Can I ask a funny question?
Go for it.
I want to address the twin in the room.
The double twin in the room.
as a white heterosexual man, I find myself being in the minority for the first time in my life in this room. Mm-hmm. And that's because there's... but there's... It feels good. It feels empowering. There's four twins in here, which is really cool. Four identical twins. Two twins, is that...
I can't remember a time in my life that I've been in a room of another set of twins. I'll meet one twin, but...
There's more twins here than there are non-twins here.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Taking over.
That's so cool. We're minority here, guys. Don't impress me. For listeners who can't see in the studio, you're two twin dancers. How does that play out in your performance? Is it something you actually do you kind of play with it, or do you want to avoid it because it's too obvious to. Yeah.
Oh, it's quite interesting because I guess we've always danced together since we were, I don't know, five or whatever. But I guess we've kind of tried to avoid it, especially at Unitech, because it's quite a common thing, like you get compared or...
You do the mirror dance.
Yeah, it's just like... all these. Yeah, so you kind of want to avoid it. We kind of tried to avoid going in groups together or anything like that. And then this is the only kind of time that we've been like, oh, okay, let's actually create something together. Like, we move well together. We move very similarly. We have similar ideas. We like the same things. So we're like, okay, this is a great idea. And then our duet is kind of playing. It's got lots of different ideas, but it's playing with that idea as well. And we use polystyrene heads. You know those ones that people put wigs on and stuff?
Mm.
We use those as props in our piece. So, yeah, we're playing with, like, identity and...
Did you see In the Mind of Igor, Akram Khan's...
No.
Akram Khan's dance company, when they came and did In the Mind of Eagle, there are a set of twins in there, Sade and Christine Elaine.
No.
Amazing dancers, and there was a moment where they did this piece together, and it was just stunning.
Actually, we could perform the Comedy of Errors right here, right now, that has two sets of twins in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think... No, you go. I think that even if we're not trying to be, like... Because it's a duet, even if that's not our main idea that we're trying to get across, it's just always going to read that way anyways, you know? If we're dancing apart or together, there's always that thing that people, the audience or whatever, is going to have of like, oh, they're together, it's about them. So
the connection,
Even if we don't try to get it across, it's just something that's always going to be there.
But, yeah, I mean, presumably it's an incredibly strong starting point. I mean, it's a massive advantage. That
you may as well play with it.
Yeah, you've got a thing going on. Yeah.
I think you were just speaking about like there being a bit of a commentary about identity there as well, and I think in terms of my own experience of being a twin, one thing I often reflect on, because Tess spent about 5 years overseas where I saw her twice in that time, and going from literally being inseparable, like doing everything together, and then because even your day-to-day, like going to school and coming back home, when you're doing and having dinner, when you're doing all of that and you've got all this shared context together, to then be separated for a long time and then have that person come back is quite unusual. And I think it really made me realise how strong that connection is, and that even just talking about this idea of being a twin is like a comment and a discussion about how we identify with the different people around us and how we relate to them. Because even we'll spend long periods of time together, and I'm actually quite introverted, but I don't mind being around Tess at all, and I think that I'm actually the same around her as I am just by myself.
Yeah,
which is I think something that other people don't experience. Not to say that all twins experience that. I don't know if that's similar for you guys, or if that comes across in your dancing and how you. We're really good at charades. We're so good at charades.
Freakishly good at it.
Yeah. Like, do you find that the way that you communicate with each other when you're choreographing is different or the same as when you're communicating with somebody else? I guess
you kind of don't. You don't really. What am I trying to say? I don't think of it as something different until I'm working with someone else and I'm like, oh, this happened way easy. You know, like, way more easily. Yeah. Not in a bad way. Like, it's not either a good or bad thing. It's just like, you notice that. You skip steps, or it takes a shorter amount of time because you just presume you're like, that's what's happening.
Yeah. We actually, when you said the charades thing, there's a scene in Bella's piece that she's choreographed. I don't want to give it away, but we are we are trying to say the same thing at the exact same time, which is, like, I don't feel like we're good at it, but then everyone's like, wow, you guys were so in sync, and I'm like, are we?
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
You should give it a try.
The one that people have said they find hard with me and Georgia is that we, when we have a conversation and it's mainly together, we'll stop adding in those extra bits of context and detail, and we won't realise that the other people have no idea what we're talking about. And because,
yeah,
we've been doing it since we were kids, we will talk at the same time very quickly. Yeah, my question for you would be, do you feel more comfortable or more strong, or is there any feeling that you feel when you're dancing together that would be different emotionally than with other people?
I guess it feels very, like, for me, it feels very comfortable. Like, I don't feel, often I'm just like, I don't even feel like I'm performing. I mean, I do.
Everyday life.
It just feels, yeah, it just feels very natural. I guess, like, it does with close friends, but, yeah, it doesn't, there's no awkward moments at any time. Or
we just have the same idea or have the same kind of goal of what's, of what we want to happen. Yeah, so we don't have to talk about it as much or
kind of, like, communicate via...
just the classic.
Yeah.
Just the classic.
Hey, going back about 25 steps, Greg, just before you were making a comment about obviously being not... being a white cisgendered man, I'm wondering...
And bald. I want to throw that in there.
I just,
and
ginger.
Only in the beard.
I can't even tell.
Can I just go and get my violin case?
I was just... I was wondering then, I had this thought, your books are about a young woman, a young, presumably strong woman, finding herself in a journey on her own. Why?
Yeah.
What's made you want to write about that?
A couple of things. I've got two lovely daughters who are 5.5 and 3.5. And, you know, I grew up in a family where mum was, like, a very senior person. She was CEO of a hospital. Dad was, you know, very capable but also very comfortable about playing a support role. So, you know... You know, I guess I didn't have a... It was a very traditional upbringing in many respects, but... and then you think, oh, yeah, I'm a pretty kind of sophisticated guy in the way I think about gender and so on, and then you have two daughters of your own, and you're like, wait a minute, I'm a dinosaur. and you start, you know... And so, I mean, I've been teaching my eldest to throw a good punch, and, you know, she regularly wallops me in the kidneys, and, and you know, you think a lot about it... you know, even the way you dress your children, you know, and the way that you see people talk to them. I hate it when people say, oh, you're so pretty in that dress. Mm. It's like, don't say that to my daughter. Like, she's not defined by how she looks, you know. And you know, getting kids dressed in the morning and, you know, the idea of putting them in footwear that would be inappropriate for climbing a tree, you know, it just, I hate that. It's and don't climb the tree because you get dressed dirty. It's like there's none of that in our house. So, you know, so my head was in that kind of space. And then I had this idea for the story and was kind of cooking it up in my head. And it was very kind of almost cliched adventure. And I liked everything about the story except for the main character. And I was sitting down with a friend of mine who's a very good editor. She edits Emily Simpson, the editor of Sunday Magazine. And she's got an incredible kind of... head for literature and that sort of thing. She was like, well, maybe you should just make your main character a girl. And I was just complaining that my main character is a cliched kind of reflection of masculine self-expression, and it's just like, oh, god damn, that's a boring character. You know, it's like it was a Luke Skywalker kind of thing. It's like, young man finds out that he's got something going on, you know. And then a kind of light just went on in my head, and it was, suddenly everything was a lot more satisfying as a female character. It's like, okay, she's going to be really tough. And I guess I don't want to say it would be unexpected to a reader, but it's just a little more refreshing. So it's a nice role to write.
Do you find yourself inspired by your daughters as well? Like now writing, I was about to say, you know how you like those moments where you call yourself on your like assumptions all the time. I was about to say, like, now that you're writing about a female character, not that if you're writing about a male character, you couldn't be inspired by your daughters.
Inspired in what way? What do you mean?
Like, do you ever have moments, like, day-to-day where you think, like, wow, I love that characteristic, or they say something and you think...
Like, no. I'm going to write that in.
Yeah, or not so much.
Not so much. They're different ages.
Yeah.
My main character has been kidnapped in the Far East and is in the back of a ute in the opening scene, so I don't want that.
No. Is she... The character, is she from the Middle East or is she a Kiwi?
So again with the white middle class bald ganger guy from Christchurch, I'm going to throw an extra cliche aspect about myself in every time we go around.
Oh God.
Yeah, I know.
Spice and Beads or St. Andrews?
No, sir. The old Xavier, come on. God, where were we? Who is she? So she, her name's Beth Singer, and so she's the daughter of a diplomat who is working in a fictionalised country, very kind of Afghanistan-y part of the world, and he is half English, half Indian, and so his backstory is that his father came over and kind of changed his name from Singh to Singer as a kind of, you know... cultural kind of inclusion thing back in the day. Yeah. So she doesn't really identify as a kind of as Indian necessarily.
Yeah.
And she's been floating around in international schools with just her dad, totally absent father, going off to various far-flung postings, and then her dad writes her a letter and says, you know, come join me. I think it's time that we spent some time together and this country is safe now, and da 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 da, and then story starts.
Why have you chosen to write about that part of the world?
I'm fascinated by it. It's the kind of very the back story to it is there was a culture called the Kushan Empire there a couple of thousand years ago, and it was sort of a big melting pot. It was around the north of India, Pakistan, parts of Iran, Iraq. I'm not sure about Iraq, maybe actually. And most of Afghanistan, I think, was all part of the Kushan Empire. It's this huge empire and parts of China as well. So it was a massive melting pot. And it was also kind of religious and intellectual melting pot. So it's a really neat kind of understory to kind of put in there. And yonks ago, I was sub-editor for the Herald. And you had to kind of do a lot of background research, and a lot of the news was coming through about ISIS and that part of the world, and all sorts. And do you remember the Yazidi culture? They're a group of people that ISIS was persecuting. Excuse me, this is a long-winded sort of story, but and I was like, who are these Yazidi people? You know, YAZIDI. It's a fantastic name. Why are these fanatics persecuting them? And they believe that they're devil worshippers. And the Yazidis are very, very old people. Their religious story predates Christianity, but they believe in all the same stories and the kind of the fall and the Garden of Eden and all that sort of thing. Except they worship the character who we call Satan.
Yeah.
Before. Jews and Christians had thought about, you know, good and evil and the devil and temptation. They had the same story.
Yeah.
And there's a direct line back from them through the Zoroastrians or through Iran and some of those religions in there. So short story is there's a massive melting pot of religions and ideas in that part of the world.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to bring in one key element into the story that I'm telling, which is, I guess the key question is, can you do something good by doing something bad?
Yeah.
And that's where the Yazidis and a bunch of other people kind of differ from classical Christianity, where we think of there being such a thing as good and evil.
Yeah.
And they see them as two sides of the same coin. So it's, I'm just playing with that idea, and it's a very teenage point, you know, being 14 is when a lot of people have a really, remember having this massively strong sense of morality and you're learning about the world and you're just like really forthright about things. So I just wanted to put her in a place where she had to make a really grey decision instead of it being a really black and white decision, and put it in a place that was a very mixed place with lots of different ideas that I could kind of throw around.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a very long-winded answer.
No, that was like, that was super interesting, and actually it did conveniently have me kind of thinking about, obviously we have Phoebe here as well from The Two Gentlemen of Verona, and I was kind of thinking about all this research that we do if we're doing something in the arts now, and how we put that into a context of today. And I was wondering, Phoebe, if maybe you could talk a little bit about the production you're putting on now, The Two Gentlemen of Verona, and how, when you're doing something that was written, I saw that it's predicted that it's written sometime between 1589 and 1593, something that's written such a long time ago.
Yeah.
How do you bring that into a context of today?
Well, we're doing it, for starters, we've got an all-female cast.
Yes,
which is always great, just as Shakespeare intended. and so that brings us, like, that already presents us with a whole new thing of, like, how do we, as a cast of women, find ways to make these male characters relevant to us. It's mostly male characters, as per usual with Shakespeare. and we're presenting it in a very fringy kind of way. So it's in Aotea Square for the first week, the second week's at Auckland Uni. And we're presenting it like we're a bunch of street performers.
Yeah.
So we're all kind of doing, each got our little shtick. There's like plate spinning and there's balloon animals and puppets and all sorts of things like that. And then we come together and we perform this play, Two Gentlemen of Verona, which we've been working on. And it's, I mean, as with all Shakespeare, the themes in it are just so relevant today. Yeah. Like, it's all about gender stuff. It's a very much a story of, like, these two dudes from Verona who go off on their OE, essentially, and one of them goes first, and he's just after, like, adventure and, like, growth and things, and the other one stays behind because he's got a lover back in Verona, but eventually he decides to leave her and go off and follow his mate, and they think they're going to have, like, a totally great rack of a time, and it all completely disintegrates into this total like mess of love triangles and like it's all the stuff between them and their friendships and their love and relationships and stuff. And yes, it is, it's a very fun play. It all just feels, I don't know, completely.
Is it a comedy? Shakespeare wrote it as a comedy?
Yes, it's a comedy. It's hilarious. It's really funny. There's also two dogs in it, so
Cool.
I was just thinking when you were talking about recasting male characters as female, and you've rewritten this. Was there much rewriting involved?
It was a lot. Yeah, probably 10. No, not rewriting, but all my notes had the male character. Then it was just like, ding, let's just change.
Because I remember seeing Kate Blanchett talking about, you know, roles for women, and that often writers create characters that could easily be female characters, but their default is to write them as men. And she said, you know, 9 times out of 10, you could go through a script and
just change the name.
Change the
What do you think gender of that, Tama? Like, do you think it's important to write roles that are like for a man or for a woman, or not so much?
I don't know. I mean, I sort of don't intersect that. Where it interests me is that the world's narrative is controlled by white men, straight white men, and, you know, certainly in terms of Te Ao Māori, cultural appropriation is a massive issue, and it's, I see it regularly, and certainly within Western art forms, you know, opera does it a lot, lots of other things do it, theatre does it regularly. When you exist within a colonization context, you become attuned to it and hypersensitive and hyper aware to it, because our narrative has to find space so regularly and assert itself. So where it interests me is that, really. Do we need one more... No shade intended here, but do we need one more white man writing about a woman of colour, or do we actually need to hear the narrative from a woman of colour?
Mm. Well, we're an all-female cast and production team doing a pretty feminist play, really, but it's written by a dude, and so that's the question, is like... Mm. Sure, we can find our way into this story and what's interesting about it to us, but at the end of the day, we're telling a dude's story. Mm. We're all the main characters are dudes.
Yeah.
I saw Julius Caesar at the Pop-Up Globe recently.
I've heard that's incredible. Is that all female cast as well?
Well, it's a gender-reversed cast, so all the male characters are played by women and the two female characters are played by men. And they've flipped it. So they're playing the males as females. So they've changed all the pronouns. And Julius Caesar is a woman. She is like the Empress of Rome. And we're not doing that with our show. We are playing the men as men and the women as women. But what was amazing about hearing Julius Caesar from a female point of view is not only hearing women like saying all those lines and being super powerful and, you know, deeply complex and manipulative and light and shade and all that good and bad stuff, but it was all the lines which, like, talking about mankind and everything we hear is the age of man, the history of man, but they said the age of women has come, you know, like, and throughout the history of women we've never seen and that, just hearing that as a woman was like, it brought a whole new meaning to hearing the world talked about like that. It was really cool.
I think I sort of see it in two, you know, we were talking about, in two different ways, talking about, you know, the way I kind of had a character and then flipped it. I think in some ways, like if you're thinking about Hollywood scripts and kind of from a kind of employment justice kind of way, it's really important to just be open to that kind of thing. It's like, you know, it could just be a woman's role. And it's a bit like Lego, you know, we're supposed to do a whole bunch of female characters, and they're like, yeah, what kind of characters will we do? We've got the cowboy, and we've got the ninja, and they went out to us, you know, they designed all these, you know, pink dolly ones, and everyone's like, nah, we want just the ninja girl and the ninja cowboy. You know, it's you don't have to kind of do things like that. But on the other hand, like you say, you know, one more white dude writing his story. I think even if I'm writing female roles or whatever, you know, Lena Dunham's not going to write the same kind of story as me. It's still going to be a male point of view story. So it's I don't know. I think it's just important not to like claim it as the story.
Absolutely. I think it's an interesting conversation to have. And you know, Eve, you were talking about this character being a character who has to make grey choices, and I think the whole, you know, even just talking about like ideas around gender or representation, that's what it is, it's grey, you know, and there's no black and white solution to it. But even I was started to watch a really fantastic show last week, Transparent, but you know, even which is about a man, rephrase, it's about a woman coming out as a trans woman to her family, probably in her 70s, and that the main character is played by a cisgendered straight white man, and how that's been quite controversial. Not only the allegations of sexual assault have come out, but even, you know, even before that, that there are so little opportunities for trans men and women to play any characters, let alone trans men and women, that those opportunities should be given. And I think that, to me, I do actually see it as quite a black and white thing, at least now in this day and age. And even, you know, the idea of having Shakespeare, you know, even just putting that into a contemporary context, for that just to be an all-female cast or something like that. I know a friend of mine, Regan, has been performing in
Solothello,
which is, it's all in Māori, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and if you think about Troilus and Cressida a few years back, Rachel House directed and went to the Globe, all in Te Reo Māori.
Yeah.
But it was thrilling. I've never seen queues of people lining up outside the town hall to go and see theatre.
Yeah.
but yeah, I mean, might have helped that it was a koha entry, but but even so, people, it's not determined by the price. It was determined by the excitement around the concept, and it just, it brought all sorts of people. And I remember seeing Raymond Hawthorne weeping and declaring that this is how all Shakespeare should feel.
Yeah, but I think accessibility is an important part of that as well. And actually, I will segue soon into your review, Tess, because Tess is reviewing Splore, and so many things in this conversation has been really making me think about my experience this weekend. One of those things is Splore is a festival, even though I loved it, Splore is a festival for white people.
Mm.
It was just like, to me, it seemed as though like 95% of the people there were white, you know, and I was thinking, you know, what are the reasons behind that, and how do we make it, how do we make festivals like this, how do we make the arts more accessible to people in this day and age, you know? And is that something, as you within your involvement in the Auckland Arts Festival, Tama, that you hold dear? Is it something that you hold on to while you're kind of thinking about, you know, your involvement and the kind of projects you want to be involved in and how that program would be facilitated?
Absolutely. Can I just say, though, in defence of Splore,
yeah,
having played there a few years ago,
okay,
I think when anything is good, mainstream comes to claim it.
Yeah.
And mainstream New Zealand is white.
Yep.
And, you know, mainstream money New Zealand is even whiter than white.
Mm.
So I don't know that it's the event's fault,
yeah,
that mainstream culture has come to claim something, which I think they've got an amazing group of people who put that festival together.
Oh,
incredible, yeah, people who work on it. Diverse artistic offering, not just in terms of the artists themselves, but in terms of what arts are being offered up. So,
well, even Rhea Hall opened up the main stage this year, and it was incredible. But it was one of those moments where I was going, if I look at the stage, this is incredible. If I look around, I can see, like, there's a man in a poncho with a Buddha head all over it, and just, and more dream catchers than I've ever seen.
There was a really controversial, just recently, queer hip-hop artist, African-American, I can't remember his name, performing in the States, and came up on stage to do a guest feature, and but before he went into the track, asked all the white people to get off stage, and he said, "Check your privilege, can I just have some black people on stage?" And it was, you know, there are all sorts of responses to that, and I've probably given that in a very simplistic way. But what he was saying is, for this one song, for this three or 4 minutes, can the people who are like me share the stage?
Yeah.
And can you sit down and let someone else have the microphone? That was the essence of the moment. It would feel pretty shit in the moment too, but yeah, it's interesting. I mean, going back to the festival, we worked really hard to try and be accessible, but we are a mainstream institution. We're not fringe, but we are an Auckland institution, so we have a regional remit, and we have to try in some way to connect with as many Aucklanders and all the flavours and types of Auckland that exist. And, you know, we are growing in that capacity, but I would say, you know, everybody has a long, long way to go. We've got an amazing team who work across disciplines, and even talking about accessibility, we have two staff who have created a whole accessibility program so that, you know, hearing impaired or, you know, visually impaired or wheelchair bound or, you know, relaxed performances are occurring throughout. There are touch tours, there are signed performances, there are audio described performances. Actually, And that's just the beginning of that. Jonathan Bielski, our artistic director, really is building on the work that Carla Van Zon did previously, which is trying to step out of our privilege and hear from and see everybody else who's out there and deserves a voice and a platform. And it's not our job to speak for them. It's our job to provide the platform.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting the way you kind of... I find it interesting the way you identify where you come from in terms of, like, you know, okay, so we're at this kind of festival and our obligations might be this or that. And whenever you think about this sort of stuff, the kind of the shade of Don Brash kind of starts to hover, in, hover into the room, you know. And I sort of think, you know, for instance, a Shakespeare performance all in Māori, you know, I don't think, no matter what Don thinks, that anyone's got any obligation to translate that or make it accessible for anyone else. Whereas if you're in a particular festival context, you know, maybe that's your, that's what, you know, your goal is to make something accessible to all sorts of different people. Whereas that DJ guy personally would have felt that really stink and probably put, would have left, but he's got no obligation to provide a particular kind of experience to anyone. So it's kind of like, okay, you can make me feel stink and I can handle feeling stink from time to time.
Yeah.
If that's what you want to do, then that's what you want to do. Whereas if it's in a different kind of a broader context of you're in a festival or something and you've got an obligation to kind of actually see who's out there and talk to everybody.
Yeah,
maybe.
We have these moments as well where we kind of go, like, actually, you know, go, I saw, I forget what it's called, Mo and Susie kill someone. Jess.
Mo and Susie kill Susie.
Yeah, I think it's that. Yeah. Like, you're a Henderson,
eh? Yeah, oh, I saw that.
Ani Pikituari and Crystal Lee Brown.
Yes, I saw that out at Te Pau, and it was, like, so incredible, and I speak like very, very little Māori, like just the most basic Māori, and I absolutely enjoyed that show so much, and it made me realise as well the importance of stepping out of that assumption and naming that assumption, you know, that you know, like, you know, Don Brash saying that that things should be in English because that's for everybody, but to recognise that as an assumption, and as an assumption from a place of privilege, but that's not actually the story of everybody. And it's the more that we assume that it's the story of everybody, the further and further we kind of fall down that hole. Yeah. I love conversations like these.
Yeah, yeah.
This is so great. Sorry, Tess, I am conscious that we're now at 9 o'clock. We're already two-thirds of the way through the show, and we will have shameless promotion coming out at the end where you can give us all the details of what it is that you're here to talk about and how we can access it, and all of those details. But that does take a few minutes. So
we've actually got Don Brash coming in to read that out.
I hope he's coming in. This is the moment I was born for.
Yeah.
On that, and on that kind of commentary as well, we like, and also Tess and I can very much relate to you, Greg, in terms of you were speaking about your upbringing and that you kind of your mum was more career orientated, maybe, when your dad was quite comfortable in more of a supportive role, and that absolutely was the case for us. And our mum, who is the coolest woman ever but quite cute at times, did the cutest thing a couple of weeks ago where she sent Jacinda Ardern some books for her kid with a card saying it worked really well for us. And our, you know, for us, it's the, like, the mum went back to work like 2 weeks after we were born and all of our siblings, because that's what she was doing. She was supporting the family, and she's done incredibly well, and we're like so proud of the work she does and the work she does in the community. And we're so proud of our dad, who's like, has these incredible qualities that would be considered more maternal qualities, but for us, like, it's so masculine because that's our dad, and it's meant for all of us as well. Like, and that's how it is for me and my household as well with my partner. That's like, we're kind of talking about, you know, as we like move into a house of our own and stuff, it's just for me this assumption that I'm going to be doing career, I'm going to be doing my work, and that's how it is for me. And if that didn't work for my partner, that's tough luck, because I'm a strong, independent woman.
Yes, queen.
Yes, Queen.
Thank you.
I would love to speak that take that introduction to go from strong independent woman into talking about Splore. I think that it's crazy to go past Splore and not comment on it. I think it's an incredible festival. I think it's such a privilege for us to be able to go to something like that that is so incredibly creative and artistic and
clean.
We went to Splore this weekend to go and support our dad and also our little brother. Our little brother's 17, and he played with his friend Isaac. Their band is called Centuries, and I'm going to take this opportunity to shameless plug Centuries.
Oh, because they're great.
They were so good. And Splore as a festival has this beautiful way of allowing all these people to come and just express themselves, and not only express yourself just who you are, but who you want to be, and whatever clothing you want to wear. The best one that we saw was this very tall bearded man, and he was wearing a suit that went from maybe half a meter above his head to half a meter outside his body on every side, and it was just made of sort of quite thick brown straw. And it was just these maybe meter-long strings of it, and it would just trail behind him. Yeah. And he was walking around like there was nothing wrong.
I thought he was a part of the performance, and then I realised, no, he's just on the stage because he's doing it. He was just on the stage wandering. With a big staff.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it.
Wow. Super cool. Dude,
keep away from campfires. That is terrifying me from a health perspective.
One of the best things about Splore is they ban fire. They ban glass. We weren't allowed to bring our olives in. Splore, they've really thought about their footprint, and they really thought about the land that they're on, and how they can best cater for that. They encourage you on the website or the information that you get before you go to do things like, if you're bringing cucumbers, take the plastic wrap off it. We don't want it. We don't want it in our bins. Mm. Every time you go to bins, there are bins everywhere. There's three of them. There's a compost, there's a recycling, and there's a normal bin, a normal waste bin, and there is signs on each one about what you can and can't put in there. Everything that they bring in terms of the businesses has to be biodegradable packaging, so that it can be put in the compost. And there's little people beside every bin to tell you which one you can use. I learned stuff from going to the bins at Splore, and that's what a festival should be, because it should be about you go there, you have an amazing time, and you leave and you go, I want to be more creative in my life, and I want to support these bands, and I want to support New Zealand bands. And one of the biggest things that we were talking about was one of the cool things about Splore is women just wear whatever they want, and they wear as little as they want.
I think men too,
men too.
I saw quite a few Speedos, and it was like,
but it's
legit.
Not, I feel like I lived in Spain, so when I see a man in Speedos, I go, that's just a man in Speedos. When I see a woman walking around in just like a crazy skirt and with glitter all over her chest, I go, wow, that's a woman with her body that I can see. And I, as a young woman, never get to see women actually looking how they really look.
And it was everywhere. And it's non-sexualized.
And it is so non-sexualized. And on your little brochure with all of the information of all the acts, there's also a little part that says whether you have glitter on your cleavage or not, or whether that person has glitter on their cleavage or not, consent is an enthusiastic yes. And if you want to touch someone, maybe you could ask them, would it be okay for me to hug you? And I just think it's such a beautiful part of Splore. This, we see it as a music festival, and it's so much more than that. Really cool. One of the highlights for us was seeing a band called The New Telepathics, which is, they're a really, really big band, and they're loads of different cultures, and they're all wearing big white scientist jackets, and they're all sort of on an equal level on the stage, so you can see everyone. There's no particular front man or front woman, and they were just singing songs that were anti-war. And it was so cool and just, like, inspiring and groovy. And you've got all these people up on the hill dancing and going, yeah! You know, he said that there are only three countries in our whole world that have no place in war at the moment. And that just blew my mind. And then I thought about it and I went, but it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even in a little country like us, we're part of it. We're part of the machine.
Mm-hmm. What are the three countries? Do you know?
I don't know. I need to look it up.
Switzerland?
I love it when someone gives you
like a little snippet of something that makes you go, I'm really interested in that. I need to know more about it. And then they don't tell you.
Mystery.
That's cool. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm not really a music... I'm a music festival person. I work for music festivals, so I'm a one-day music festival person. Mm. But I find it... I need my 8 hours of sleep.
They're hard work.
They are hard work, especially when you get your temp from Kmart the day before. It was what was our review of the tent? It's like the ocean, cold and wet.
Georgia's tent can be reviewed as I was in a nice Kathmandu tent, and Georgia wasn't. And there were these young people that were walking past our tents this morning, and one of them loudly went, "Oh, I feel sorry for the person in that tent." Oh. And I got a text from Georgia that just went, "That was so about my
tent." You think as well, they had been up literally all night, and I know that because they came back at 6 a.m. and woke me up from my... I'd been asleep for 6 hours, though. I'm an old woman now. I'm 25, so I can't stay up past 12 o'clock. And I was thinking, if they, who were still drunk at like 6:30, 7:30, can walk past my tent and say, "I feel sorry for the person in that tent."
Yeah, that tent is a shambles.
When
drunk, you know, having critique at 6 a.m.
Wouldn't recommend that. But I think as well, that's my tips for music festivals, though, is get a good tent. If you can afford it, do some of the glamping or bring a camper.
Oh, glamping.
And bring a water bottle.
$2,000.
Bring a water bottle. And if you get face paint, don't forget you got face paint and then sleep in it. Because when you wake up, your pillow's ruined.
Quick plug, this was the last thing I was going to do. The people that do all the body painting Explore, if you see any of the promotion, it'll probably be the people there. I think it's pronounced Body Fix. It's BODYFX.
They're in Kingsland.
Kingsland, and the paints and the glitter that they use is all really safe for your skin, but also for the environment. All of the glitter that they use and that they sell is biodegradable, which is epic, and they are so clever. For anyone who's part of the theatre or who's putting on festivals and wants face painting, 10 out of 10. So cool.
They're amazing. Cool. I might just, if it's okay, I might just quickly segue from your review into my review, because I went and saw Force Field this week as a part of the Fringe Festival, and I'm seeing some nods because I'm sure it's getting amazing reviews everywhere. And in terms of this idea that we've been talking about throughout the show of minority groups telling their stories, Force Field is the story of a young Down syndrome man who is also played by an actor called Duncan Armstrong, who is a young Down syndrome man, I think from Wellington, because they're a part of the company Everybody Cool Lives Here. And I went and saw the show this week. It's kind of this sci-fi kind of feeling commentary about relationships that we have with other people and how we can create them in our minds, and also this idea about technology. I don't know if you've seen Her, the story about the guy who falls in love with his iOS system. It's kind of similar to that, but you're not quite sure whether the Chris, the main character, whether he has imagined or not imagined this character that he is getting to know and falling in love with. And it's this really interesting commentary as well about how we learn what we need from ourselves and for ourselves from these relationships that we have with other people. And I just thought it was incredible. I thought Duncan Armstrong, the main actor, thought 50 minutes by yourself on the stage is incredibly brave, and he was just so witty and engaging, and the way he moved his body was just, he did some like absolutely hilarious dancing, but then also just you know, really moving around the staging, moving around the set to represent different things at different times depending on what was happening. And it just I was just so impressed, and I'd love to see more from Duncan Armstrong and more from Everybody Cool Lives Here. And I assume that they'll be doing a season now in Wellington. So if anybody sees that force field, definitely go see it. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. It's, I've seen a few things so far this year, and this would absolutely be the highlight for me. And I love that idea as well of, you know, how often do you get to see... How often do you get to see the story of someone who has Down syndrome, and how often do you get to see that played by someone who's Down syndrome as well? I thought that was incredibly powerful. But also, I didn't even know that going into it. It wasn't a selling point for me. It just was. And I thought that was really cool. So I really enjoyed that. Cool. What is time? It is already 9:10. Sorry, the show is going very quickly. Tama, could you give us a bit of a rundown on Auckland Art Festival and what we've got to expect this year? Is it the whole of March?
Pretty much, yeah. So officially we open on the 8th of March, and we open that night with Theatre Danger Spiel at the Festival Playground in Solo Park. But they've just arrived in the country. English National Ballet are doing Giselle. So that's on the 2nd, 3rd of March. Mm-hmm. So we have a little teaser, and then the festival proper kicks off on the 8th. And one of the things I'm very excited about is that we have this great big... So normally we've been in Aotea Square with the festival hub. You know, people come down and see the Spiegel tent there, and there's a garden stage and sometimes two tents, and... This year we're down in Silo Park.
That's Silo Park is a new kind of addition to the festival?
Yeah, it's a new statement. So Angus Muir has designed this area called the Festival Playground, and there's a music arena where we're putting on acts like Edu Dangerspiel and Neil Finn with the APO and Aldous Harding, Perfume Genius, Daniel Caesar, King Krul, Rhea Hall, Tiki Tane, A Tribe Called Red, Lee Fields and the Expressions, Jack Broadbent, Teeks, Emily King, Tank and the Bangers. It's epic. And the Matt Lemon Bucket Orchestra, Anika Moore, Bombay Royale, inside Silo 6 itself, this beautiful artist, Piata Larkin, is doing an exhibition called Tauhere. And that space is so... I just think it's an incredible space that it's sort of evocative, and artists come into it and immediately fall in love with the possibilities in there. There's six old grain silos. The acoustic in there is amazing. And Piata's work... She's done some incredible work with light boxes that uses pixels and the concept of taniko patterns, so just really vibrant and interesting contemporary take on something quite traditional, but then the acoustic itself lends itself to trippy amazingness. And Jonathan Crayford is coming in to, there's a series called Sonic Silos, so he has a concert in there. He's bringing in a Steinway D to perform. That's on March 20th, I think. And then Voices Chamber Choir are also coming in because the acoustic is so rich. And there's a Taonga Pūoro making workshop that Horomuna Horo is doing on Whānau Day at the end of the festival. So around that, there's the House of Mirrors, which is a mirror maze that's sort of, you know, it won't make people like me look thin, but it might get you lost for an hour or so. And it's quite a mystical experience, and has this very gothic feel to it. So that's the playground. There's yummy food and, you know, hipsters with man buns, I don't know. And then across the rest of the festival, we're trying to get as far and wide as we can. So Anika Moore is taking Chop Chop Haya, her show for kids, from Wellsford to Waiuku, and pretty much exclusively going to places that are out of reach of the CBD. That was really important to Jonathan, to send someone high profile out to regions that might not necessarily have a famous person come and do things. And then there is Initiative Whānui, which is our, you know, you talk about iwi whānui as the extended, or iwi at large, or whānau whānui as the wider whānau. So whānui is a project led by Norma Seal Salapu and Angela Green at the festival to bring in the voices and ideas of our wider community into the festival itself. It's not curated by us, it's curated by the communities that are presenting their work. So out in Glen Innes, you've got Mad Ave presenting Home Fires, which is a festival within a festival within a festival, happening towards the end. And there's Imagine the Land, which is an intergenerational conversation between elderly and young school kids. It's led by Ekarasa Dobrovich. And then out east, Alice Canton and Julie Zhu are working in one of the schools out there to unpack the idea of death with young people. Mm. And so that's developing into something really interesting. And then you've got all the blockbusters. So Naked Samoans doing magic, which is going to be incredible.
I've heard so many people talking about that.
Yeah. I mean, Nina Nawalawalo, award-winning director who brought Vula, who the white guitar, Marama, who herself comes from this rich history of having learnt magic. And the premise is the Naked Samoans did this big show 20 years ago and only one person came. It was a total failure. They've all been traumatised, and then they mysteriously get an invitation to a will reading, and it turns out to be the one person who was in the audience, Sione Dini, who is a magician. And he says he bequeaths them his house in Ponsonby, but only if they put on another show that includes magic. And so it's riotous. Bless the Child, Hone Koka, who is an iconic New Zealand playwright. I read somewhere today that more of his plays have been performed in Wellington than anybody else other than Shakespeare, which is amazing. And he says of this, it's his best work yet. So quite exciting. It poses questions at the Māori middle class. It also examines child abuse, but the root of where that comes from, and puts us all into a space where we need to think about our role in changing the stakes for people.
It's just overwhelming. I don't mean that in the most positive way. It's so exciting. I've had a little squiz at the schedule the other day, and it's just like there's just so many things that pop out, and I love how accessible that it is as well. You know, being in Auckland as well, Auckland is just huge, but you know, as someone who lives in the CBD but comes out from Te Tārangi, I love the idea that there's things all around the place. Very cool.
Yeah, we're trying, we're getting there, and this is probably the biggest festival so far. I think we're welcoming a total of 1,200 artists to the festival, which is almost three times last year's. And you know, there isn't necessarily something for everybody. Body Double is coming, which is exciting, co-produced with Silo Theatre, Eleanor Bishop, Julia Croft, but we've certainly tried to go as many places as we can.
Where is the best place for people to go if they're looking to get tickets for things? Or look at the schedule.
Just go straight to the website, aaffestival.co.nz, Auckland Arts Festival.
Cool. I was looking on the Facebook as well, and it's pretty cool. But obviously there's so much of it that really to look at the schedule, a bit easier.
Yeah. There's also programs and daily event guides all over the city. There's probably some in the library. If they're not in your cafe, tell them they need it.
Yeah, cool. Or people could maybe, I presume as well, people could rock down to the playground.
Yep, Festival Playground tickets will be available. Ticketmaster, the Festival Club, actually, because even though we're not physically in the square in the same way, Angus has designed this, I'll call it groovy, Festival Club. And the whole theme is Yeah Baby, so it's got this kind of 60s, 70s lounge catch. It's glorious red everywhere.
Yeah.
And there's even a resident band MD by Robin Kelly, called The Year Babies, so who do sort of 60s, 70s lounge versions of contemporary pop.
I love a theme everybody can do something with.
Yeah.
And could you, going back to this discussion we had at the beginning as well about Mahi Narangi Tōka and the show that's coming up, which is commemorating her, Love Me As I Am, could you tell us about the dates that that's on as well?
Absolutely. So it's the Friday the 16th and Saturday the 17th of March, 8 o'clock. It's at the Auckland Town Hall. It's going to be a magical show. I am biased. It's hard to be objective.
Oh, but even, you know, you listed off some of the people that are involved at the beginning, and, you know, it's such a strong statement that all of those people would want to be involved.
Yeah. And lots of different flavours too. Claire Cowan is doing some arrangements, string arrangements for it. Joel Mulholland is looking after the band. Yeah, there's a lot of great musos coming in. It's exciting.
So exciting. I can't wait to see it. Phoebe, where can we see The Two Gentlemen of Verona?
You can see it from Tuesday to Sunday this week coming. That's the 27th to the 4th in Altea Square, 6 o'clock every night. And it's an hour, just over an hour. So it's over just after 7 o'clock, so you can go see lots of other fringe shows afterwards. There's heaps of shows starting from 7:30 right into late in the night. So make a night of it. And we're actually also doing the following week from the 7th of March to, I think, the Saturday the 11th in the Auckland Uni Campus under the Clock Tower. That's a ticketed event. The next week in Aotea Square is a Koha event, so go to the ATM before you come, get out some $100 notes.
Okay, cool. And maybe if people turn up early while they're waiting...
Greg, there will be... Oh, sorry.
Well, I was thinking, Greg, maybe they could read some of one of your books.
Sure, it won't take you long. Very fast-paced, very... Yeah.
If they wanted to do that, where would they be able to find them?
Easiest thing to do would be to go to Amazon.com and just search for my name, which is Greg Rowan, R-O-U-G-H-A-N, or just go to gregrowan.com. Easy.
I love a good Kindle book. I like to read on my phone. I
know
it's unpopular.
Now, I read on my phone now. It's I used to hate the idea, but I can do it on the bus.
It's because you can change the colours. So, like, for me, I've got very sensitive eyes, but it means I can do it in bed at night, and it's like I do it with a dark background and then, like, a sepia. I'm just saying people should go, and they could test it out with your book.
Good angle. Thank you.
Okay. All right, fantastic. And I can't wait. I can't wait to read it. I think I'll come back and do a review.
Yay, thank you.
Yeah, it'll be great. I'm sure. I've already started the review.
it'll be great, I'm sure.
Yeah. Natasha.
Phenomenal 4 stars.
Brittany. Natasha and Brittany, thank you so much for coming in and representing Dance Plant Collective and talking to us about your show. Where can we come and see it? Where can we get tickets?
So we are opening this Thursday, 1st of March, and it is on till Sunday, the 4th of March, 7:30 p.m. at Studio 1 Toy 2 in Ponsonby, that big brick building by the art station and the gas station.
Is it the one with, like, the
paint dripping?
Would you know that I've never been there? How terrible is that? This is the perfect excuse.
Yeah.
I feel embarrassed now.
It's a beautiful building. Mm. It's the old police station, I believe. Yeah, it's really, really nice.
Fantastic. And I can, like, I'll get a good idea of what the floors are like because you guys will, I presume, be using it.
We'll be rolling.
Quite a lot.
Yeah. Rolling around, yeah.
Cool. Very exciting. Tess Parker, thank you for coming in and reviewing Splore and co-hosting for me.
You're welcome.
You're doing what I do. See, Richard always gives me this look because I, like, by the end of the show, I've only got, like, 2 or 3 words left in my head. But you're welcome in any time because you ask very good questions.
Thanks.
At one point I sent her a text saying, epic question, in capitals. Thank you so much all for coming in. Like, what is such a fantastic show and such a fantastic discussion. And actually, Phoebe, what you guys are doing with The Two Gentlemen of Verona have... you've inspired me for my last song to close down with. And
is
I'm
Verona by Elimino P? Because it better be.
Oh, I love that song. I like to send that song to people line by line in capitals. It's really good. I'm sure they love it. The Broods, Georgia Knox from The Broods, has been a part of a project called the Venus Project, and they're an all-female project, like producers, writers, everything the whole way along, and it's so brilliant. And they released a song a couple of weeks ago, which is like, I listened to it once and then I listened to it again and then I just listened to it like 4 or 5 times because I liked it so much. It's called Won't Hurt. Everybody should check it out. But I'm actually going to put on the release that came out on Friday so we can catch a little bit of the end of that as the show ends, and it's called Need a Man, and it's really good. So this is the Venus Project with Need a Man. All right, see you later, everybody. Thanks for listening to our show. Remember to go kick some arts.